Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
And Elena Katz-Chernin's wistful theme introduces another Late Night Live, which I think tonight is going to be a considerable treat. Had he not died, had he not gone to the paradise he'd so vividly imagined in 1674, the English poet and polemicist John Milton would be 400, pretty much about now. So we think it's time to devote an entire programme to a discussion of his life and work. Now, most of you, dear listeners, will know Milton as the author of Paradise Lost, regarded by many as the greatest poem in the English language and one which gives Satan all the best lines. I'm also deeply fond of it because of its revelation that there is sex in heaven, albeit frictionless. You must all try that at home after the program, frictionless sex. But even without Paradise Lost, Milton would be one of the more fascinating characters in history, a religious and political radical. He defended the killing of King Charles I, worked as a bureaucrat for Cromwell, survived lots of things with a mixture of luck and skill, imprisonment, the threat of execution, the plague, the Great Fire of London, and even after the death of two wives, two children, and total blindness, continued to write on the themes that preoccupied him most: free will, rebellion, sexual liberty, and the nature of God. And they're pretty much the principal subjects that have interested this program for the past 20 years. We hope to be joined by two of the greatest Milton scholars. One of our eagles has already landed. Stephen Fallon is Professor of Liberal Studies and English at the University of Notre Dame. His books include Milton Among the Philosophers, Poetry and Materialism in 17th Century England, and Milton's Peculiar Grace, Self-Representation and Authority. Steve is currently in Australia to speak at a symposium being held by the University of Queensland entitled Milton in Intellectual and Cultural History, and he's in our Brisbane studio. And we hope soon to have to make contact with Nigel Smith. Nigel's Professor of English at Princeton. He's the author of the new and provocatively entitled Is Milton Better Than Shakespeare? And we hope to be able to settle this matter by the end of the program. But to do that, we'll have to find Nigel, who is meant to be talking to us from Princeton's very own studios. At the moment, we're not getting through. So, Stephen, welcome to our little wireless program. Would you be kind enough to take the listener back 400 years to give us the gist of Milton's early life? I understand that his dad was a scrivener, which is not a title often employed in the 21st century.
Right. Milton's father was an interesting character. He was the son of a Catholic up in Oxfordshire. He was told to leave home because he was discovered with an English Bible, he was disowned by his father. He moved to London and became a scrivener, which is something like, be facetious about it, a human Xerox machine. He was a legal document copier. Scriveners were also the moneylenders. So John Milton Sr. made his fortune lending money. And he raised a considerable fortune that allowed him to raise John Milton as a student and young intellectual, send him to university, and then send him on a grand tour of Europe.
I understand that as a lad he studied Latin, Greek, French, Italian, Hebrew, mm-hmm. possibly Aramaic.
Yes. He set out He had an excellent classical education at St. Paul's School in London, and then he set himself additional tasks himself to master what could be read and could be known. So he had a very self-driven, consciously planned effort to make himself into a kind of universal intellectual.
Is there truth in the story that this intensity of study would precipitate his blindness?
Yes and no. In his own mind, the answer is yes. He thought his lifelong hard study did, in fact, weaken his eyesight. I think that the consensus now among medical historians is that he suffered detached retinas, which had nothing to do with hard study. So in his mind, he gave up his eyesight to study and eventually gave up his eyesight to the service of England in the defense of the execution of Charles I, writing that work, writing his defense of the English people against, over the objections of doctors. But in fact, I think he would have gone blind anyway.
Steve, you mentioned his travels. Shakespeare, of course, goes to Verona, goes to Venice, goes to Rome in his splendid imaginings.
Right.
Whereas your bloke actually does it. And to my astonishment, I had no idea, meets Galileo.
Right, right. Galileo is an important figure for Milton because he's the one figure, one contemporary figure who appears by name in Paradise Lost, or except appears at all. I mean, the other figure that was a close contemporary would be Christopher Columbus. Galileo is important to Milton as a voice of free speech against repression. He's been silenced by the Inquisition, and Milton presents himself as having met Galileo under house arrest in Fiesole, after having been silenced by the Italian authorities.
He also, of course, is in the homeland of Dante and Virgil, and I understand that they sort of this inspires to some extent Paradise Lost.
Yes, I mean, Milton wrote in retrospect about this trip that he was admitted to and mixed with the highest literary societies in Italy. He was very proud of that. And there's a little bit of a paradox or tension in this. Italy, of course, is a Catholic country. Milton's a staunch anti-Catholic. And at the same time, he was welcomed in and proud to be welcome in Catholic intellectual circles and made the acquaintance of cardinals, for example. He also would self-consciously set out to write a work in English that would do for England what Virgil had done for Italy and what Homer had done for Greece and what Dante had done for modern Italy.
Yeah.
As he said, with this over and above of being a Christian. In other words, he would be a great literary stylist and he would be the first one to tell the truth.
Now, with beating heart, I am now going to ask, are you there, Nigel?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. I was getting just a little anxious.
Yeah.
Nigel, we've whizzed through some of the early years, but I'd like to bring you in on this point of his perambulations in Italy. I understand that what is sort of the tyranny of the Catholic Church intensified his disapproval of the institution.
Yeah, I think that's right, and from what I've gathered of the conversation so far, I think I'd agree with Stephen that his experience of talking to intellectuals in Italy, the most famous of whom is Galileo, sharpened his sense that the church was, or the Roman Catholic Church, exercised a kind of tyranny over the possibilities for free thought.
What we've already established that scrivener is not a term that's in much contemporary usage. I wonder what the notion of intellectual was back then, Nigel. Clearly it's a term of the modern era.
Well, I suppose there's a degree of anachronism there, but what we're talking about is educated people who lived in... because of their education, lived inside a very privileged realm where they had the means to speculate about the nature of the universe, God, all sorts of things. The nature.
What
of
I'm
the
getting at
world.
Is they had that sense of privilege. They knew who they were.
They did indeed, and they were a fairly small group of people. One of the things that interested Milton about Italy was that intellectuals got together in small groups known as societies, and they would gather for discussion. This was reasonably rare in England. It wasn't quite so well established outside of universities, and I think he gained a lot of encouragement through reading his verse and talking within societies in Italy.
Steve, you described this extraordinary fellow as a transgressor, and physicality seems to be interesting. He wore his hair long like a prophet.
Yes. He's an interesting case, I guess, of a round head with long hair, and he was interested. I think he cultivated a sense of himself as singular, for a variety of reasons. I mean, he stood out as a Cambridge undergraduate, and he was known as the Lady of Christ. And there are various ways to speculate about why he got that nickname. But in his own mind, he stood apart from his fellow undergraduates because of his moral propriety. And he found in moral propriety the spring or engine of his poetic and prophetic power. So in a way, it's a little bit paradoxical. I mean, his transgression in this case was a transgression against the kind of what he would see as the laxer morals of his contemporaries. But at the same time, as his career developed, he became more and more transgressive in ways that we would think of as less paradoxical.
Nigel, he defends the regicide of Charles I and was fundamentally opposed to the principle of monarchy. When and how did he come to these views?
When and how he became certain that monarchy we could do without is a very interesting question. A lot of people who supported the parliament had begun to see that monarchy as an institution was harmful for the kingdom some time before the regicide actually happened in 1649, at the end of January in 1649. So I think we have to put Milton amongst that group. But in his earlier writings from the earlier 1640s, when he's actually attacking the bishops, he appears to be saying that we need to reform the monarchy. But as the 1640s goes on, there are all kinds of elements which we think of as part and parcel of a non-monarchical republican vision, such as the elevation of the life of the citizen and the virtue that the citizen can both deliver and enjoy. I think he had figured out that the king had become a tyrant, that tyranny was to be resisted. It was rightful one way or another for the people to resist a tyrant, and hence he published The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates. Soon after that moment, he's recruited by the new republican government to be the Secretary for Foreign Tongues. That's to say, a senior civil servant involved in translating documents in and out of Latin and foreign European languages. And at that point becomes a more or less an official ideologue for the new regime.
As you must know, Nigel, you're talking to a nation that from time to time has an argument about whether or not it should be a republic. We're about to have another one of these Barneys. And what advice do you think Milton would be giving us? What configuration of republic should we go for?
I'm going to answer this question making it clear that I'm an Englishman born in a monarchy but who lives now in a republic. And what I think Milton would say to the Australians today is you need to think about in what ways you are not free on account of the political system in which you live? What are the ways in which you do not enjoy freedom on account of the constitution in which you live, the rules of government which pertain in your country? And when you've figured out that, you need next to work out how to reform them so that you are free. And Milton has a very extensive idea of what it is to be a slave and hence to be not free. One of the categories of slavery, I suppose, in Milton's writing is the category of idolatry, to worship a false image, which in a sense in Milton has a political dimension as well as a religious one.
My eagles have landed, as you can hear, dear listener. They are Nigel Smith, Professor and Chair of the Renaissance Studies Committee at Princeton, and Stephen Fallon, who's Professor of Liberal Studies and English at the University of Notre Dame. He became a bit disappointed, though, didn't he, with Cromwell, as his rule became increasingly to resemble that of a king's?
Well, yes, everyone should be aware that there are two distinct periods of the English Commonwealth, the 11 years in which England was not a monarchy. And the first period from 1649 through to the end of 1653 is a period of a republic. Oliver Cromwell is an influential figure, but he's the chief soldier. He's not in charge of things. After December 1653, he becomes the Lord Protector. And it's the protectorate period that scholars think of as the period when Cromwell becomes offensive to those who had supported him, because to them he is a tyrant. Milton treads a very careful line here. He remains during the protectorate a civil servant and an apologist for the regime. But certainly it's the case that we can see in some of the later 1650s writings veiled criticism of the protectorate regime. Nonetheless, Milton also praises it. There's another very interesting component, which is that it may be that Milton had become extremely concerned about the possibility that the English could ever take their own freedom into their own hands and establish it. And that's as early as the point of the execution of the king itself.
Before we push on with the politics, Stephen, give me a sense of where he was in regard to religion at this time.
That's an interesting question. If I might add one thing about the politics, I think what Nigel said is all accurate and sharply focused. I think that Milton also would be stressing that one need not be a tyrant to be deposable. If theoretically, if someone could take away one's liberty, then a free citizen should be able to throw off that government. So one doesn't need to depend on a person acting tyrannically, as he perceived Charles to be acting tyrannically. In terms of the religion, Milton underwent a kind of an odyssey, or one can see him moving, one might say, from the right to the left in sort of rough terms in religion in his own life, and also extending to the life of his forebears, a Catholic grandfather, a Calvinist Anglican father. By the early 1640s, he was throwing in his lot with the Presbyterians, and a parliamentary party who were opposing the government of the Church of England by bishops. Disenchantment with the Presbyterians for a number of reasons, one of which was the outraged response to his writings on marriage and divorce. He was moving more and more to a position in which he was sort of the sole priest and congregant in the Church of One. and along the way as well, he is moving toward a kind of hyper-Protestantism. So if Protestants believe in the priesthood of all believers, in opposition to set prayer, in the idea of being led by the Spirit, Milton emphasized all these very strongly. And in doing so, particularly in the last, the idea of being led by the Spirit, and there's something here that relates him to the Quakers. He was moved away from and outside of institutions and relying more and more on the vision of the individual in dialogue with the Bible and the Spirit.
We'll come back to his religious writings in just a minute, but first, Nigel, what happens to Milton with the restoration of the monarchy? Surely he would have been on the short list for execution.
Yes, he was in trouble. He went into hiding in a friend's house when the king returned, and there was discussion in Parliament about whether he should be punished, along with other other people who had supported the execution of the king. Those who had actually signed Charles I's death warrant, many of them were tried and executed and met very grisly ends. Milton was protected in part by his junior colleague in the Commonwealth Administration, who'd become a Member of Parliament in the new regime, and that's the poet Andrew Marvell. And Marvell certainly spoke up in Parliament about how Milton should be left alone. He was kept under house arrest, effectively, let's say, for a while, and then lived a private life for the rest of his years, which doesn't mean to say at all that he turned away from public matters as he lived in this retirement. Of course, he finished his great work, Paradise Lost, and he wrote Paradise Regained, his second greatest work, arguably, and finished or entirely wrote Samson Agonistes.
I want to discuss that that particular text shortly. Thank you for reminding me of it, Steve. Just as we're living in a time when the incumbent president blurs politics and religion, we're looking at a period in English history where they were inextricably intertwined. What was the religious dimension of Milton's support for the execution of Charles I?
That's an interesting question. Part of the answer to that is that Charles was seen as Catholicizing, Romanizing, and Milton was very concerned that Roman Catholicism not have a gain a foothold in England through the monarchy, and he also thought that Charles himself was idolatrous in his religious practice. So I think that was a very important element in Milton's opposition to Charles I. At the same time, Milton's view of the Republic was a view of a godly republic, and there is an element in it. This might be too provocative to insist upon, but there is a strong element of theocracy in Milton's understanding of republicanism. Eventually, those who would be fit to rule, and even those who would be fit to elect the rulers, would be those who were upright and godly, or what he called sometimes the uprighter sort. And
then, Steve, forgive me for interrupting, but
yes.
I find this is quite difficult to get your mind around, because there's also the argument that he saw the ideal of a relationship with God unmediated by ecclesiastical authority.
Right.
It doesn't seem to go well with the argument of a theocracy.
Right, and I'm going to say here that I think that all this was not as clearly worked out in Milton's mind as it perhaps it should have done, and Nigel might want to jump in here and say something different. But the Milton, eventually, by the time he comes to write The Ready and Easy Way to Establish a Free Commonwealth in 1660, on the very eve of the Restoration, when all the other sort of rats had left the sinking ship, Milton still planted his flag against monarchy at a time when it was a as Nigel suggested, involved a great amount of physical courage. At this point, Milton is talking about electing of a perpetual Senate. The Senate is going to be elected through a series of elections that become more and more refined with smaller and smaller electorates. There's no apparent principle except the electors will be more and more godly and upright. So in some ways, his political prescription is utopian or impossible. It involves a kind of sense of getting closer and closer to the truth as led by the Spirit, but this is something one can't test for in any kind of secular political context. So there's a kind of tension between what he wants to see happen in the state and his own views of the individual being led by the Spirit, and I'm not sure the two ever really meet up.
What do you think, Nigel? Do you think that's a good description?
Yes, I think that is a good description. The one category that we have strongly in modern political life that is going to give us problems in understanding Milton's position is democracy. Milton is not a democrat in the modern sense of the word. So although he thinks that people should be free, that doesn't mean to say that they should all have the right to vote, especially if they're going to vote back a monarchy. And that's his problem, that as events turned through the period of the Commonwealth in the 1650s, so it became clear that if the people were given their choice, they'd bring back the king, or it was a very strong risk that they'd bring back the king, which leads Milton to the conclusion that people don't understand how they're free, and therefore we have to have a kind of restrictive form of government in which the conditions of freedom are maintained. And of course we have a problem with that nonetheless. What's valuable to me in what he says is that he thinks that there should be a very broad degree of opinion in certainly in religious belief and in the right to think through almost anything else. And he's seeking political conditions for that to happen. And Catholicism is the big problem because it denies that.
Stephen, you're teetering on the brink of blasphemy tomorrow at the University of Queensland in that your paper is entitled Why Milton is Not a Religious Writer.
Right.
I'm gobsmacked.
Okay. Yeah, Milton is a deeply theological writer who wrote biblical epics and wrote a long Latin treatise on Christian doctrine. But I think that I'm calling him not a religious writer for a fairly simple reason. Milton, like other Christians, believe that we are fallen and that we're then predisposed to sin, and that only grace can rescue us from this predisposition, and that without that grace, we are going to continue to sin and fall further and further into a kind of obduracy and eventually into damnation. And one can think of someone like John Bunyan as a salient case, grace abounding in the chief of sinners. So one defines oneself as a sinner. This is a theology that Milton himself endorses, not only in Paradise Lost, but also in his Christian doctrine. But Milton, when he writes about himself, and he does writes about himself whenever he gets a chance to, and even when he doesn't really have a chance to, he invents chances to or opportunities to do this. He writes about himself as if he has never sinned. He tells stories of heroic and preternatural virtue. Now, the idea of telling a story about oneself as a sinner, it was so strong as to be nearly mandatory.
Well, it still is, isn't it?
Yes.
It's required by presidential candidates, for example.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if too much so and you're out of the running, but just the right amount of sin, apparently. But I think that Milton, there's a gap between how he considers himself and what he thinks of as the general human condition. And nowhere in his writing do we get anything like a conversion story. And the conversion story is simply mandatory. So there's this gap, and then Milton, I think, is seeing himself as what he accused pagan philosophers of being, which is depending on their virtue alone without divine help or grace.
Nigel, let's talk about his commitment to freedom. Where does it come from?
Another good question. I'm not sure it's ultimately in the Bible, although he certainly finds evidence for it there. And
he could read the original Hebrew, couldn't he?
Well, yes, I suppose accurately we're not really sure how good he was at Hebrew, but he certainly knew some. But yes, he's certainly very competent at Greek, so he could read the New Testament in its original. Now, the point I would make is that right at the heart of Paradise Lost, and it finds its first mature statement in Areopagitica as early as 1644, is his emphasis upon free will, that we have the right to choose. God gives us that right, and to choose good from evil. And that is completely different to the reigning theology of the day, which is called predestination, where God determines who is damned and who is saved. I don't suppose Milton would have denied that God might have predestined someone to salvation, but for most of us, we have the choice, and he says that without that choice being at the heart of human experience, it's impossible that mankind was made in God's image. And that seems to me to be crucial and right at the heart of Milton's thought. Now, he takes his text actually from Aristotle originally, that the formulation is reason is but choosing. And choosing comes from the Greek word from which we now take our word heresy. So Milton reinstitutes the original meaning of heresy, which he says is choice, to choose. So when we're using our reason, which is absolutely crucial for him, all aspects of life should be governed by reason. And if they're not, then it's idolatry. Reason is but choosing. And the notion of freedom, which I've just said, has a source in Milton in ancient political thought, the thought of the pagans. That's the beginning. He reconciles it with parts of Judeo-Christian theology so that they appear in his text as one continuum. But there is that very strong pagan element there. And, of course, it's from ancient political thought as well as ancient philosophy that he builds his theory of liberty in a political sense.
This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via the web and podcast, and we're discussing the life and times of John Milton with Notre Dame's Steve Fallon and Princeton's Nigel Smith. Steve, I must confess to being a little rusty on Paradise Lost and swatting for the night. I suddenly recall that theologically this is a rather odd work, in that he has Jesus present at the creation.
Right. Well, Jesus is, what he calls him in Paradise Lost is the Son of God. And the Son of God is the Father's word and effectual might. So for Milton, what emerges in Paradise Lost and what's clear in the Christian doctrine, the Son of God is not co-equal with God or co-essential with God. The Father is a unitary God. The Son is not only is at creation and as the agent of creation, but he himself was created in time or begotten in time. And the Holy Spirit is the Spirit of the Father, but is not a separate divine person as well. So Paradise Lost is an epic which has at its center anti-Trinitarianism, which is an extraordinarily dangerous heresy in Milton's time and place.
Now, you talked about earlier in our discussion his habit, his need to talk about himself in his writings, and there's a fair bit of him, isn't there, in the text? There's bits of his biography, blindness, hardship, and so on.
Yeah, in different ways. So in some ways we see Milton in his characters. We see him clearly, for example, in a minor character named Abdiel, who's the one faithful angel in the group of angels that Satan brings to the north and seduces them to become devils. So Milton writes about Abdiel, among the faithless, faithful only he. And I think that is Milton thinking about himself in 1660 when the other people were abandoning the good old cause of republicanism. We also see Milton in his own voice as the narrator. And Milton talks about the process of writing the poem. And in that process, we see him both talking about his special status as one who is allowed, as he says, to see and tell of things invisible to mortal sight, but also someone who is anxious about the possible transgression involved in that, the kind of presumption in telling stories that perhaps are not stories that human beings can have access to. And we also see him elsewhere. We see him in Adam, I think. We see him in Raphael. We see him in the angels. But finally, we see him also in the character of Satan, who wanted to go above his peers and equal the Most High, and had a kind of adventurous flight. And Milton describes himself as taking an adventurous flight in his inspiration in writing the poem. So there's an uneasy sense in Paradise Lost that on the one hand, Milton thinks he is specially gifted as a prophet, but if he's wrong, if he's making it all up, he is perhaps converging with the damned Satan.
Now, William Blake famously declares that Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it, doesn't he, Steve?
Right.
And so the figure of Satan in Paradise Lost has to be, well, perhaps the most argued over character in world literature.
Yes. Yes, and that story is familiar to many. I mean, we have Shelley saying that Milton's Satan is a more moral being than his God. Blake saying he was Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it. And that this is a complicated one. I think that clearly Satan is a character of great energy. He's given some wonderful lines. At the same time, one can take almost anything Satan says in the poem and go elsewhere in the poem and find that what he says is factually undermined. So Satan becomes a kind of seductive figure whom we can thrill to, but if we're paying attention, we'll learn that he is a rock upon which we can founder. At the same time, though, I think that, as I suggested a moment ago, Milton is, in a sense, perhaps of the devil's party, and perhaps he knows it a bit more. Milton is very much aware of the kind of high-stakes game he's playing. If he is in fact inspired, I think, in his own mind, he's going to feel secure. If he's not in fact inspired, and I think Milton did at some level believe in inspiration, but if he had began to have doubts about it, then his position does converge with the position of Satan, who is out of his place, who's making claims for himself that can't be sustained. And I think at some level, Milton in Paradise Lost is aware of the danger that he is more like Satan than he wants to be.
Nigel, are we as readers meant to reject this Satan, well, the way Eve should have?
Well, on one level, yes. You're meant to see that many aspects of Satan's character and the way Satan proceeds are to be rejected. But on the other hand, and unavoidably, Satan resonates with equally many aspects of human experience and things that chime with Milton's own lifetime, which any reader, any sensitive reader, can readily pick up in the poem. And we identify with them. Satan's rebellion is done in the name of freedom. It's also true that he presents himself as a tyrant, that one of the other rebel angels imagines the destruction of God. Quite terrifying things. But so that you could say that Satan is offered to us in a profoundly ambivalent way, but there's no doubt that the narrator puts the reader in the position of being in sympathy with Satan.
Now, Nigel, I have to now raise the question of sexuality. The listener would be bitterly disappointed if I didn't. And as you've pointed out on many an occasion, Paradise Lost is a very sensuous poem.
Yes. And in many ways, Milton's writings about sexualities throughout his career rank as some of the most exciting and rebellious parts of Milton. In his portrayal of love in Paradise, it starts in Book 4 of Paradise Lost, Milton makes it clear that there was sex in Paradise. It was debated in his day and before, and denied.
It still is, Nigel. It still is within the religious department here at the ABC. That used to be a hot topic.
I see. Well, that's very interesting. In one of the most outspoken moments in Paradise Lost, Milton accuses those who deny that there was sex in Paradise as basically moral prudes and people who aren't brave enough to think about how life might have been with our first parents. And then comes some of the greatest poetry in the English language as Milton explores the life of Adam and Eve. It's quite an astonishing series of passages.
And really deeply moving and sympathetic in his treatment of them.
Yes, that's right. And what of course he has to the forefront of his attention is the fact that they are innocent. They are entirely unfallen. The language in which perforce he's describing them is fallen, but they are unfallen and they're innocent. And he tries to get the reader to imagine quite how that might have been in a natural universe, which is also unfallen. When the fall happens, nature falls too. Very sad moment later in the poem. So the nuptial bower where Adam and Eve have paradisal sex is full of roses which are continually shedding their petals on the first parents who are the lovers. And those roses never die, even though petals are falling all the time. It's quite an astonishing piece of writing.
Nigel, before we tracked you down tonight, I was tantalising the listener with the revelation, I think that's an appropriate word, that angels had frictionless sex.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's another great moment in Paradise Lost. Everyone should be aware that although Milton is usually thought of as a Puritan, he had a great sense of humour. It's very subtle and indeed wry sense of humour. And one of the moments in which it comes out is a discussion in Book 8 between Adam and Raphael. Raphael's been telling Adam about how the universe works. And he's, in fact, been trying to limit the extent of Adam's inquiry, telling him what it's worth to think about and what not. And Adam starts to offer his own experience and says that, well, basically Eve totally takes away my reason. She's so powerfully attractive to me. And Raphael says, that's quite enough. You've got to rein that in. And you've got to see that your reason must guide you in all of this. And that's the as it were, the theologically correct version of the poem. And then Adam's curiosity pushes further. And he says, love not the angels. Of course, that's the question that Raphael didn't really want to hear. And he blushes. There's an angelic blush. And he says,
as indeed I am, Nigel, as you speak.
I see. Well, what he then says is he has to give Adam an answer. So he after he blushes, he says, well, I can't tell you everything about it, and you probably won't understand everything about angelic sex, but we do love each other, and we do that by sort of getting inside each other's substance. Angels do have substance in Milton's universe, but it's very, very refined. And therefore much, much less gross than flesh, so that it doesn't seem to involve friction as human bodies and things on the world are arranged.
Steve, let's look at sexuality in its more lubricious sense, because this leads us into his scandalous promotion of divorce. Tell us about that.
Right. Milton had a interesting series of books on marriage and divorce. He argued that marriage is instituted by God for mutual solace and content, that if individuals could not please each other, then there was nothing that should be holding them together, that God would not against their will hold them together in a miserable marriage. He had a strongly idealized sense of what marriage should be. He disputed the idea that marriage marriage was primarily for procreation, or that it was primarily economic. Marriage was to be a source of mutual content and what he called a fit conversation between spirits. And this involved him in a remarkable claims for the, I think, the status of women in his time. Milton is a very, very complex and in some ways contradictory on the relation of men and women. On the one hand, he thinks that marriage should be a meeting of, if not equals, near equals. On the other hand, he begins to argue that if marriages don't work, it's because of the recalcitrant and willful woman. So there's sort of some kind of misogynistic backlash. Milton, and as Nigel says, strongly emphasizes sexuality, and his poetry can be quite erotic. Milton, at the same time, de-emphasizes children, which is quite interesting. So it's it's very important. If I could go back for a minute to Book 8, it's interesting in adding on to what Nigel said, in Book 8 of Paradise Lost, Adam and Raphael end up, in a sense, arguing about human sexuality. Raphael presents what should be seen as a kind of higher sexuality, but for us it's not a higher sexuality. And I think Adam is, at this point, not accepting what Raphael is telling him. And in the process of this, Milton is overturning a long tradition that Nigel also referred to, which placed reason over passion. And Milton, in some ways, this is why the Romantics, I think, picked up on him, one of the many reasons, Milton places at this point and this moment, this aspect of our lives, passion over reason. Adam talks about his own unfallen, vehement desire, which is a kind of mindless desire for Eve. And this should be set off warning bells, and some Milton scholars think that we should see warning bells here. But I think Milton is saying that here in Paradise, we have this meaning of man and woman, which is intellectual, it's social, it's spiritual, it's also physical, and it's all endorsed by God, and that Raphael surprisingly is the creature who, not having access to human sexuality, underestimates it and misunderstands it. And Milton, I think, in his divorce tracts, puts out there a very forward-looking, I don't want to be presentist about this, but progressive look at what marriage can be and should be. But there's a gap between what he thinks he should have as a husband, what he's found as a husband, and then we have a kind of titanic lashing out against the woman who's prevented his own solace and content.
Nigel, I accused Steve earlier of at least literary blasphemy by suggesting in tomorrow's paper that that Milton is not a religious writer. I'm now going to make the same accusation of you because of your book title suggesting that Milton is better than Shakespeare. Nigel, how dare you? And why dare you?
Why? Well, one riposte to me, of course, is that they're such different kinds of writer. Shakespeare, public playwright, and Milton, almost entirely a poet and then a prose pamphleteer, working in entirely different realms. However, what I was getting at, and so therefore why did I say this, is this, that through the 18th and the 19th centuries, Milton was pretty much considered as the literary equal of Shakespeare. And I think that's true down to the beginning of the 20th century. Now, while Milton enjoys a very solid reputation with the scholars, and he's studied a lot, he doesn't any longer enjoy the mass literary reputation with the reading public that he used to do, as the number of people who read literature has grown through the 20th century and into our own, or the current century. You'll find often a bookcase and more of books in a bookshop on Shakespeare, but maybe half a shelf.
Nigel, during the silent era alone of cinema, there were over 500 Shakespeare films. There haven't been too many films of Paradise Lost, but you would also argue that he's more relevant, urgently so, for us in our time because of his focus on liberty.
Well, yes, that's right. That's what I would say. Ultimately, there are things that Milton does with poetry and with the expression of liberty and freedom through poetry, that amounts in many respects to a literary achievement that exceeds that of Shakespeare. And Paradise Lost is such a tremendous, world-class literary achievement that we simply can't afford to forget it.
What's your view on this, Steve?
I think that they're very close to what Nigel has just said. I think that Shakespeare has a great advantage in that one can produce his plays and that they are vastly entertaining, and Shakespeare is a great genius. We're less of a reading culture in some ways. Well, Nigel's right to say that more people read literature than used to because they're higher numbers of the literate. We're not a culture that reads poetry as much as we used to. So whereas in World War I, if you looked into a knapsack of a soldier, and Paul Fussell's written about this, you're likely to find, if you find any books, Pilgrim's Progress, the Bible, and Paradise Lost. Between that time and now, the reading public for poetry has declined. The poetry itself has not gotten worse. Milton takes some work to read, but the rewards for reading him are nearly incalculable. So I think that while Milton is someone worth reading because what he has to tell us, he's an idiosyncratic a thinker with the strength of his convictions. He's also an extraordinarily deft, subtle, and exquisite poet. And I think that's where he, not having the advantage that Shakespeare has of being producible on the stage as entertainment, always involving more work from the reader, it's the part of the job of someone like myself or Nigel, I think, to convince more and more people that the time they put into Milton will be more than worth it in the payoff.
It was certainly the view of the founding fathers of the American Republic, wasn't it? Jefferson, John Adams, et al.
Absolutely.
Were enormously influenced by Milton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nigel, probably haven't got time to do this, but there's a wonderful, sad story about what happened to Milton's poor body a century or so after his death. But we'll have to leave that hanging in the air because we just don't have the chance to go into the gruesome details. But you do contend, don't you, that Milton has a particular and urgent resonance in the US?
Yes, and that's partly because he was read. He was read throughout the English-speaking world, but the colonial Americans certainly read him. Paradise Lost was very popular, as were a number of the prose tracts, including Areopagitica.
We've got to wind it up, gentlemen. I've badly timed the ending, and we're out of it. But thank you very much, Nigel Smith, Professor of English at Princeton, author of Is Milton Better Than Shakespeare? And thanks to you, Stephen Fallon, Professor of Liberal Studies in English at the University of Notre Dame. Steve is a guest of the University of Queensland Symposium, Milton in Intellectual and Cultural History. And you give a public talk on Milton and religion in Brisbane tomorrow night. And you can find the details on these events on the LNL website. On our next, I'll take you back to the Garma Festival in Arnhem Land for a real treat, a chat with Sir Tiffany O'Regan, who, believe it or not, is the chief of the entire South Island of New Zealand and a wittier and wiser fellow. It's hard to imagine, let alone meet. And we're also going to have a Barney about the Community Development Employment Project. I do not exaggerate, it's one of the more memorable brawls you'll hear on our little wireless program. Stick around now for the news. No, don't. Go off and read some Milton. Let the ABC's Radio National News just drift onto the ether. Time for Paradise Lost. Thank you.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.